Hello and good morning, everyone. Again, George Patron here, a pediatrician. Spent my second career in the Army as a pediatrician, interested in behavioral health and also family advocacy. So I've joined the PCPCC Special Interest Group on integrating mental health into our medical home clinics. And actually very interested and excited, along with you, to hear from Qualis Health and Catherine Phillips this morning. They went ahead and put together a safety net medical home initiative, which I invite you to go on to the links Tara sent and read on it some time ago, and realized that they want to do an excellent job of integrating behavioral health, and so lined up a series of partners she's going to talk about. The Commonwealth Fund started with Qualis Health, and then the McColl Center for Healthcare Innovation and the Ames Center in the University of Washington. We'll be joined by one of her colleagues for the Q&A here a little bit later in the hour to talk about integrating behavioral health into primary care settings and specifically into their safety net medical home. So as the director of the SNMHI, Catherine is going to bring us up to speed on a new guidebook, guidelines, and updated tools that we, any of us, can use, large or small practices, organizations, to learn from those who have gone before us in integrating behavioral health. So with that, Catherine, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. So the Behavioral Health Integration Implementation Guide, which I'm going to review with you today, was released on October 1st, but its history goes back quite a ways. So I'd like to describe how and why we produced the guide, describe some of its strengths and what we hope it will contribute, and then we'll open the line for both your questions and your reactions to this new tool. So first, the history. In 2008, with support from the Commonwealth Fund and eight regional foundations, Qualis Health, the organization I'm from, and the McColl Center for Healthcare Innovation launched the Safety Net Medical Home Initiative. And that was the first national patient-centered medical home demonstration to focus on safety net practices. Federally qualified healthcare centers, rural health centers, homeless health centers, and the like. So that initiative helped 65 sites in five states implement the PCMH model of care and also to achieve NCQA recognition or a state-based equivalent. And it also trained a network of medical home facilitators or practice coaches based in state primary care associations, regional health improvement networks, and other local organizations. One of the primary goals of the initiative was to develop and test an operational, so practical, and evidence-based framework to guide PCMH transformation. And we called this the Change Concepts for Practice Transformation. And in partnership with the practices that participated in the initiative and the 20 or so coaches as well, we developed and published a comprehensive library of implementation resources and tools to support that framework. So implementation guides on expanding access, in building care teams, and so forth. All of these resources and tools were designed by and for primary care practices. And while they were designed specifically for safety net practices, they've been used by all types of practices and health systems, academic medical centers, private practices, the whole gamut. And in the final year of the initiative, we had the opportunity to critically review the tool set that we had created over the 5 years of the Safety Net Medical Home Initiative, and to make some updates and improvements. And we also had the opportunity to reflect on the progress of the sites that we had supported in the initiative, to gather feedback from them on their experience, to look at the data we had collected on their progress, understand how that had happened, what had been helpful over time. And we also gathered feedback from their coaches on their experience as well. And we heard loud and clear that neither our framework nor our tool set included enough guidance on integrating behavioral health into the primary care setting. And that was a fair critique. In 2008, when we designed the change concepts and began building and publishing these materials, we included coordinating behavioral health care as an element of care coordination, one of the core components of the PCMH model of care. But it wasn't something that we stressed. We considered it, you know, at that time, really a PCMH 2.0 type of effort. So in 2013, again, with support from the Commonwealth Fund, we set out to fill that gap in our framework and that gap in our library of resources and tools. We partnered with the University of Washington's AIMS Center to develop a behavioral health integration implementation guide to join that library. And Anna Rotsliff, the lead author of the guide, will be joining us later this hour to take some questions on that guide. In addition to the partners, we also had assistance from technical advisors, expert reviewers, and primary care safety net clinics that were practicing integrated care. And our advisors and expert reviewers included primary care providers and administrators, behavioral health care specialists, social workers, psychiatrists working in the primary care setting, researchers, policymakers, including NCQA, and a patient advisor and peer specialist as well. We asked this group first to recommend literature and tools they thought we should review, be aware of, consider leveraging, and also to give us their assessment on what type of resources and tools were really needed in the field. We were keenly aware that there was a lot of information out there already on the topic of behavioral health integration, and we wanted to be sure that what we created would add value and not duplicate what was out there already. So using this guidance, we then created a draft. We hosted a two-day review meeting in early 2014 where we were able to hear from this diverse group their feedback on the draft and to discuss their improvement ideas. And there were many. So we made significant changes based on the feedback we received, and the final guide that you'll see is a result of their contributions. The guide also includes 5 case examples and many more quotes and testimonials. And these were gathered from interviews we conducted with around 20 primary care sites practicing some degree of integrated behavioral health care. And our goal with these case examples was to capture the benefits of integrated care from the perspective of patients, from providers, medical assistants, administrators, other care team members, and to showcase some of the lessons these practices learned on their journey towards integrated care. So we're very grateful to our advisors, reviewers, and the case example sites for their contributions, which we believe both strengthen the guide overall and also assured its relevance for diverse primary care practice sites. So that's the history. What about the content? What's actually in the guide? We organized the guide into 6 parts. You received a copy of the executive summary along with the invitation to this event. I'd encourage everyone to go to the website, that's the safetynetmedicalhome.org site, to review the guide as a whole and navigate through some of the companion tools and resources, which I'm going to run through today just very quickly. So the guide begins part 1 with the case for behavioral health integration, and this lays out the case for change, the benefits of integrated care, again, for patients and families, for providers and care teams, and for really the practice operations itself. The second section, integrated behavioral health care, what it is and how it works, describes the spectrum of integration and makes the case that while the evidence is strongest for models that have a high degree of integration, like the collaborative care model, which I assume some of you at least are familiar with, there are many options that practices have to improve how they deliver behavioral health care services, and that the real goal of any integration effort is to identify the specific needs of the practice's specific patient population and to begin building capacity to address those needs using the resources the practice has. We provide a method and a tool to help practices define an approach in part three of the guide. It's called Implementing Integrated Behavioral Health Care, and that's the GROW Pathway Planning model and tool. And GROW stands for Goal Setting, Resource Assessment, Options, and Workflow Development. So this tool prompts a practice to first identify the population of patients it wishes to target, again, in the primary care practice. So for example, patients with depression or anxiety, patients with chronic pain, or social needs or health behavior needs. And then to identify the resources it has currently. For example, is there a social worker on staff? And also to develop a plan to address resource shortages or resource gaps. So for example, if physical space limitations in the practice may impede co-locating providers or having the right type of space for brief talk therapy sessions, what the practices can do to address those and prepare for the future. Under options, the tool presents ideas for expanding access to behavioral health services in the primary care setting through facilitated referrals or on-site providers, and also different options and methods for improving primary care's accountability for patient outcomes using measurement-based treatment-to-target approaches and so forth. The final portion of the tool, workflow, covers the changes a practice might need to make to begin delivering integrated behavioral health services. This may include, you know, new staff, patient education efforts or materials, changes to the way the patient would schedule, or new communication strategies. So we hope the structure of this tool and the questions and prompts embedded in it will be helpful for any primary care practice looking to either launch or further strengthen an integrated care effort. So that's part three. Part four provides guidance on monitoring progress, how a practice can evaluate the impact its efforts are having on patients, on providers and care team members, on the practice itself, and how it can plan to further develop its integration efforts over time. This section also includes some guidance on specific patient populations, pediatric populations, substance use disorders, and so forth. Section 5, another very practical, hands-on how-to section, is on building integrated care teams. And we focus here on how to develop and support integrated care teams. That would include the sort of traditional members of a primary care team, a physician or nurse practitioner, perhaps a nurse, a medical assistant, a front desk staff or reception member team, and how to successfully integrate into that team a behavioral health provider. It includes guidance and strategies on recruitment, on hiring, on training tips, and also some strategies to support communication among different types of healthcare providers that may have different training experiences and so forth. Part six, Leveraging Success, Spreading and Sustaining, provides guidance on how to spread integrated care if a practice has opted to begin with a pilot team or a pilot site for its integration effort, and also how to sustain changes over time by really preparing for some of the inevitable changes and challenges that happen in integrated care, and more generally with practice changes such as turnover, reimbursement issues, and such. So that is the body of the guide. There is a set of companion tools available as well. Some of these are appendices that provide more detailed information on content covered in the guide. For example, common barriers and strategies in supporting effective healthcare teams for integrated behavioral health. There's also new content and new resources that dig a little deeper, for example, on health information technology and how to use HIT to support integrated care, using an electronic health record to support communication between primary care and behavioral health specialists, how to document and track warm handoffs, and so forth. The case examples are available as standalone documents. Again, they cover a diverse sample of sites. We have one from a homeless health center based in Oregon. There's also some specific topics that are included. For an example of a story of how a practice designed a suicide prevention effort and engaged their care teams in that. We also developed an NCQA-PCMH recognition crosswalk linking some of the new requirements in the 2014 program around behavioral health care to elements of the PCMH model of care and our change concept package. So that is a very quick review of the content. What about the strengths? What makes this guide unique? Like other Safety Net Medical Home Initiative implementation guides, our behavioral health guide was specifically designed to be practical and operational. So it really focuses on the how-to. And while it's directive, we provide recommended strategies and recommended approaches, it's flexible. And that was very intentional, and it was something we received feedback and guidance on from our technical advisors and our expert reviewers. We don't use one particular model for integration. The GROW pathway planning tool that I described is really an approach a practice can use to determine its own goals, its own patient population's needs, and to determine an approach reflective of its resources and its capacity. The guide has a deep literature base, and we've included in it an annotated bibliography for teams that want to learn more about the evidence for integrated care, and also to look at some of the other examples of it in practice beyond those that we've included in our case example section. I think also the stories, the testimonials, and the examples that we have really enrich the guide and provide some good perspective on how important behavioral health care is in providing truly comprehensive and whole person care. And lastly, the way we framed the issue and the strategies, the approaches fully within the patient-centered medical home model of care and within primary care improvement efforts more generally makes it clear that behavioral health integration is no longer an optional activity. It's an absolutely critical component of patient and family-centered care. So we welcome your questions, your reactions, your thoughts on this topic today and in the weeks to come as you have a chance to dig into the guide itself, to the companion tools and resources that I went through, and experiment with those. So with that, I will end and turn it back to Dr. Patron to lead our discussion.
Okay, Catherine, thank you. Wow, it's apparent that a huge amount of work, thought, and energy went into this. First off, the Safety Net Medical Home Initiative, and then coming up with this guide after much experience already over the 5 years. I can really appreciate that you went back to monitor your own progress, and so kudos to the whole team for that. That said, we've all been talking about knowing your population in a patient-centered, and I like to add family-focused way, mm-hmm. and you certainly have hit on that. One question I start out with is that does this guide apply to all patient-centered medical homes, all primary care practices, in that you started out with specifically saying that let's look at safety net type practices. For instance, the example you gave was a homeless center, so a center providing medical care for homeless people. It sounds like you've widened it so that every practice should have, if you will, a safety net type of a plan, the treatment plan, putting it around, wrap around their clients, knowing their population. Is that pretty much, you feel that, well, I have that right, that this is for all practices now, not specific specialty type practices called safety net practices?
Yes, that's exactly right. So the guide that we've developed, and again, the GROW pathway planning tool, we feel would be relevant for any primary care setting that's seeking to provide whole person comprehensive care.
I would just ask a second question related to all of us on the line. You mentioned that this is a new guide, and it has, you just published it, and you want feedback. You want it to be utilized, and so therefore you joined us today. Has it been piloted anywhere, or is there one of the organizations, one of your partners who is currently using it, who, as we look at the material, we might call on to ask more questions as we try it out?
So the guide itself was based, again, on the experience that we had in the Safety Net Medical Home Initiative using the change concepts for practice transformation. And that framework and that tool set was extensively tested in practice. What we developed for the Behavioral Health Integration Guide was not tested in that same way. But one of the reasons that we assembled our group of technical advisors and expert reviewers, and one of the reasons we included in that group, primary care providers, primary care administrators, primary care patients, was that we wanted to have as much feedback as possible from the ground on what these practices had struggled with around integrating behavioral health care, and for those that had success, what they believed allowed them to be successful. So we asked those questions, we gathered that learning, and it is reflected in the guide that we've published to date. But we are very eager to hear reactions, and particularly from primary care practices that will be using the GROW pathway planning tool to, again, identify their population and build out a plan that will allow them to deliver integrated care, what they like about it, what they don't, what they feel is missing. And we hope to have the opportunity, as we did before, to continue revising and improving these tools based on that feedback and experience.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to just go back and recap for those who have joined us online. This is the Patient Centered Primary Care Collaborative monthly discussion on integration of behavioral health put on by the Special Interest Group. This is Dr. George Patron, and I'm going to open the line now to anyone who's been on the call. Listen to Catherine Phillips, the Director of the Safety Net Medical Home Initiative, in putting forth a guideline and multiple tools for us to use in integrating behavioral health in our practices. Catherine, before we open it to questions, I'll ask if Dr. Ratzlip is on the line. Dr. Ratzlip is with the Ames Center and is a lead author of the guide. We'll look forward to her coming on online perhaps for a summary of her own, as well as answer questions. So that said, I'm going to open the line and let the others on the line ask questions or make comments.
I've got a question. I'm Rick Lee. I'm with M3 Information. Catherine, how do these integrated sites know that somebody sitting in front of a primary care provider has a mental health problem?
Sure. So there's a couple of different ways. We cover this briefly in the guide. One of the elements of the patient-centered medical home generally is using population health management approaches. So many practices will use a screening tool. We've recommended in the guide and have some additional information on options there, the PHQ-9, which was designed specifically for use in primary care. So a primary care team would administer that screening tool to patients. That may be done on a regular basis depending on identified risk factors. And that would typically, there's a variety of different ways that tool can be, you know, administered within the practice, but a positive result on that would then yield a follow-up from a primary care provider. And primary care providers and teams are going to, you know, need, based on their own experience, confidence, training, and resources, to decide when and how they would engage a behavioral health specialist based on, you know, the problem that's been identified. So there's one, that active screening. And the second, of course, is patient presentation. We know, and we cover this in some detail in the sort of case for change, that first section, that many, many patients present in the primary care setting with behavioral health concerns.
And so the research that I've seen says that primary care providers miss about 50% of those who have depression because they don't see the obvious signs that a behavioral health professional picks up on. So you're saying that you're hoping that they see it, and if they don't, they use a depression screening tool, which may or may not be effective at identifying bipolar disorder.
Bipolar.
Yes, and one of the things that we go through in the guide is a process that a practice would need to have to identify for itself, again, based on its resources and based on its patient population needs, the different levels of behavioral health problems that it would feel comfortable managing, and the behavioral health specialist resources that would be available to it.
Yeah.
And Rick, this is Dr. Patron. I think it's important for us to look at the executive summary where Catherine went over that. They start out saying, what is integrated care, and starting out with behavioral health, to go from a low degree of integration to a high degree of integration, mm-hmm. so that the concerns of our mental health professionals, of us in primary care missing it, hopefully wouldn't be there because we're working as a team on-site, same-day access and so on, and with a quality screening process so that we, in fact, do a much better job at identifying patients who really need this type of care, regardless of whether they came in specifically with it as a chief complaint.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I also understand that we're going to create a screening system in America to identify Ebola patients, and it's just not obvious to practitioners unless they screen 100% and find that they would have missed 50% of those that they would have let go through the screening, avoid the screening process. So that's the intent of my questioning.
Understood. And I'd add one other thing to that, which is, in what we cover around building integrated care teams, one of the benefits of having an integrated care team, again, where you have a behavioral health specialist that is a full and equal member of the primary care team, is huddling with that team, is reviewing registry data and population health management data, and so forth, is that they're able to transfer knowledge and support and actually grow the capacity and ability of primary care teams to identify behavioral health issues and manage behavioral health issues through sharing that experience and knowledge.
Sure. Great.
Thank you. I'll remind questioners to state your name and perhaps the area of the country you're from. Do we have another comment or question?
Yeah, this is Dr. Larry Caesar calling from Ohio. Catherine, I really appreciate the thought and effort that has gone into this project. It seems very comprehensive and very well grounded and very timely as patient-centered medical homes is becoming almost a foregone conclusion as the foundation for the post-reform healthcare environment. And the integration of behavioral health now is pretty much a given, even among major national medical education and professional organizations. So what you have here, I think, is a great product at forth at a great time. I just want to also compliment your team on the approach that you've taken, particularly in terms of the broad definition of behavioral issues and not just limiting it to those two diagnosable mental health or substance abuse disorders, but actually looking at social concerns, other non-diagnosable health behaviors, as well as abuse of prescription medications. I appreciate your broad lens there in defining behavioral issues worthy of attention, not just, you know, formally diagnosed mental health and substance abuse disorders per se. So that's to be complimented, as is your focus on population health management. But along that line, I do have a question as I'm looking through the executive summary here. When it comes to building in measures of progress or effectiveness, it looks to me like you're looking at some set of clinical quality measures, practice transformation measures, and patient and provider experience measures. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd be curious to know, since this seems to be the key issue for a lot of funders and policymakers or even large provider organizations that are thinking about going in the direction of integrated care, to what degree do any of these measures that the guide addresses actually get down to the question of value, that is the value proposition, value being a function of cost versus outcome? To what degree is there forward consideration for how patient-centered primary care settings can demonstrate value as they move ahead to promote themselves and their services by showing bang for the buck, basically?
Sure. Okay. So under the monitoring progress section, we provide a number of recommendations on measures, and measures in different categories. You mentioned the clinical quality measures. Under practice transformation measures, there are a number that speak to value. So a couple of examples of that would be having a practice look at the number and proportion of behavioral health patients with avoidable emergency department utilization, or the number proportion of behavioral health patients with avoidable hospital readmission. The idea being that you have patients well managed in a primary care setting with a well-equipped integrated care team, that you would have fewer patients in crisis that would present at an emergency department that could be avoided, and that if you had better follow-up after an inpatient admission, that those patients would be less likely to return to the hospital for an avoidable admission there. So both of those would be dollar value examples and utilization examples. I think the other piece when we talk about value is value to patients and families and communities. And so we certainly recommend also including experience measures for patients and families, and also trying to find different ways to look at what we've sort of termed patient-centered goal attainment. So there are certainly measures that you can look at. Our PHQ-9 screening tool numbers going down, as you would hope they would, as patients are being effectively managed and treated. But you can also come up with, and we have some examples of practices in the guide who have done this, to be able to work with patients and patient advisory councils to look at when their symptoms and issues are being well managed in the primary care setting, how that impacts their life and their ability to work, work, to be productive, to fulfill their own personal goals. And I'd argue there's a value proposition there as well in the larger economic sense.
Thank you. I think that's really important. I think historically, healthcare, and in particular behavioral healthcare, has been relatively behind the curve on demonstrating measurable outcomes, which is part of the value equation. We know what the costs are, but we're not necessarily universally in agreement as to what the important outcomes are. But it does sound like you're addressing a lot of outcome measures from a number of different perspectives that could be translated into the value equation. So I appreciate your forethought on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. This is Dr. Paker, and that's a great question. And Catherine, that caused me to ask, in the partners and so on for this, are there any payers in particular who are sort of online and looking at this with you, that, who are looking at the value, including the cost of delivering healthcare?
Yes. On our expert review group, our technical advisor panel, we had a Medicaid representative from the Healthcare Authority here in Washington State who was able to describe some of their challenges around costs within the Medicaid program and beyond for behavioral health issues and for medical issues that may not be effectively resolved if patients' behavioral health needs are not fully attended to and if patients aren't getting what they need to make progress in those areas. We are not working with payers in terms of looking at claims data or cost savings data or whatnot. There is work in that area going on around the country, but it is certainly something that we need to pay attention to as we move forward and find different ways to help primary care practices move forward with integration.
Thank you. Is there another question or comment out there?
Yeah, this is Lance Lang. And I had both a comment and a question. There was a question earlier that challenged primary care docs' ability to identify patients. And I just wanted to say that I had the privilege of being part of Wayne Caton's initial studies at Group Health back in the mid-90s as a family doc. And it does, in addition to benefiting patients, it does build capacity for the primary care docs who participate just by rubbing shoulders. Yeah. So I just really wanted to reemphasize your response on that. My question, I looked briefly at the barriers piece that you, the common barriers and overcoming them. I'm in California now. And one of the biggest barriers is that in response to parity laws, many organizations have set up carve-outs so that behavioral health is managed really separately. Mm-hmm. Have you found ways to overcome those economic separations?
That's a great question, and it's something that comes up frequently as a challenge, the larger issue of reimbursement and then the example you gave more specifically. We touch on sort of the financial piece. And, you know, what we've found is that under a variety of different payment mechanisms in a variety of different reimbursement environments, there are practices that have implemented integrated care and are doing well. So it is possible, and we provide some links to examples of that and some links to resources to learn a little bit more about how practices have been able to sort of navigate reimbursement issues or limited reimbursement issues in those different payment environments. I think the carve-out one presents an additional challenge, which we don't get into in the guide, not just the the payment issue, but really how patients are involved and activated and who they think is going to be their behavioral health provider and what their benefits may be. So I don't have an answer for that. I'd welcome reactions you have or others from the group on that particular challenge.
Catherine, this is Anna Ratzliff. I just finally was able to join the call, and I wanted to just let you know that I'm on.
Thank you. And do you have a response to that question before we open it to the group?
So let me just introduce myself. I'm Anna Ratzliff. I work at the University of Washington at the Ames Center, and I wrote this guide with Qualys Health. So I appreciate the invitation to this call. I am excited to be on, even though I'm joining late. And I think that the question that was asked is a very common and challenging problem. I think oftentimes this guide, I agree, doesn't address that directly. I think the organizations and my experience is that often requires trying to look at larger policy kinds of things and sometimes taking on some of the leadership aspects that we do talk about a bit in the guide of how do you look at can some of those things that are carved out be brought in over time. But there is no easy answer to that challenge. Some organizations still use some of the principles that are talked about in the guide, but I think, again, you get less unless there's some way in which people build the bridges to those carved-out organizations and really connect them into the primary care home, medical home, it's really difficult, I think, to see the full benefits of truly integrated behavioral health care.
Thank you. This is a really perverse outcome from a well-intentioned parity law. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Les, and welcome, Anna. Dr. Patron here. Another comment or question?
I'll throw one out. Hi, this is Steve Davis from APA. I'm in Maryland. So I just wanted to congratulate you on getting this out the door. It looks like it was a lot of work and really good stuff here. Very usable. I like this bro pathway, the fact that you put it together in sort of this format that people can think through what they're missing, what they need to add, what they can handle, what they can't, and so forth. It really fleshes it out, and I'm thinking about the NCQA PCMH standards that came out this year, which go even further about making sure that there's integration of behavioral health. I think this adds the level of detail that is missing to help PCMHs, FQHCs, and other programs figure out what they need to do. One of the challenges, I think, is that, if you've seen one behavioral health integration program, you've seen one program. They're all a little bit different as far as what pieces they have or don't have and how they do things and how they integrate. And I'm wondering if you guys, as you put this together, thought of some sort of framework that allows one to compare different types of different programs, specific programs, to see who has or doesn't have A, B, or C, these different elements. And once we have that sort of thing, it would allow us to better see, which combinations of elements are most helpful in achieving various outcomes, whether they be quality, whether they be financial, et cetera. So I'm wondering about this sort of framework about how to compare different programs.
This is Anna. I will go ahead and take a stab at that, unless Catherine, you're welcome to jump in too. I guess I would say we don't look at the individual components because I think as fine a detail with intention, because our sense was when we looked at lots of different models as part of our larger review, and there are key elements that I think people can achieve lots of different ways. That's why in a way, we focused on when we talked about options, instead of saying exactly how you would achieve those different options, things like access and accountability at the individual and population level, we left a lot of flexibility there because I think people are innovating in their own communities in lots of different ways on how to achieve those goals. I think it's a good question. Could we learn from other practices what might be best ideas as far as ways to achieve those kinds of outcomes that we're looking at? And I think we can look to the evidence base to a certain extent on some of these. There are certain types of programs. For example, I work mostly in collaborative care, and that is a program that has, you know, a certain structure and has been shown through the literature to be effective at getting the kinds of population-level outcomes that are sort of the ultimate goal, in my opinion, of integrating behavioral health. And so I think we can look at those kinds of things for some guidance if you're trying to design a more ideal program. I think the strength of the GROW worksheet, though, is really that even if you do things in a very different way, you can, the biggest step of that whole GROW pathway is that whole last step of looking at, did we accomplish the goals that we set out to do? And if not, how are we going to go back and tweak things or add things? And that's where looking at some of the models that different people have presented on how they do things. I think that's one of the reasons why we included several case reviews, but there's lots of national examples of different models of or types of ways that people have come to develop these programs that could be looked at. But I think the intentionality and that commitment to continuously evaluating if you're achieving your goals is really the strength of the GROW worksheet and the piece that I think, or that whole GROW process, really, and that we did that because of exactly the challenge you're talking about, that there's lots of different components that could be contributing. And I think those could work more or less in different communities. I think that's why it ultimately is such an individualized path that people have to go on to figure out how they're going to integrate care and still accomplish the goals that they set out to accomplish. I don't know if you have anything to add, Catherine.
I think that was a good summary. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Patron. I'm in San Antonio, and while it's true that we commonly say there is no cookbook type of an effort that you've seen one, I think we find, and I found that there's more in common across the country with our culture and so on than there is different. With your effort and all this work you put into it, you talked about looking at your resources. Anna or Catherine, have you found that there's a common across the country and those who have you've been working with a resource in either personnel or space that is commonly missing that we all need to really look at making sure we have in place to properly and effectively integrate behavioral health?
This is Anna, and I would say it depends a bit on what your ultimate goal is. I think in terms of access, I think it's really critical that you think about having some capacity to deliver have a behavioral health provider on site where the patients are. Because I would say, you know, even the strongest referral process, referral is a huge barrier to patients accessing care. And then I would say on the population impact level, my sense is having some level and capacity to do care management and track patients over time, ideally using something like a registry in some capacity, are the things that I think are critical pieces that when you look at programs who have consistently impressive patient outcomes, those are features that they often are including.
Okay, thank you. Other questions or comments? We have about 5 or so minutes left in the discussion.
This is Lori Rainey from the American Psychiatric Association. I just wanted to make a comment on what Anna was just saying. There's a really nice paper that just came out from the American Journal of Managed Care that really looked at the implementation sites for the Diamond Project and sort of identified 9 factors that were associated with successful implementation. I just sent that paper over to Tara in case the group wants to take a look at it. But again, everyone's doing something a little different, but it's really interesting that even as we look at those different sites, there tend to be some core things that do pop out. So folks may want to take a look at that paper.
Thanks, Lori.
Anyone else?
Hi, this is David Pollack. Can you hear me, George?
Yep, loud and clear.
I have a slightly different comment to make, and it really nicely describes in the report the role of the psychiatric consultant, whether it be a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner or advanced practice nurse. And one of the interesting points about this is that it really underscores the role of, quote, specialists in relation to primary care homes in a way that could be extrapolated to other medical specialties like dermatology, cardiology, et cetera, not necessarily in terms of the team approach that's associated with behavioral health because of the broader needs in relation to behavioral health, but to underscore that there's a new way that we should be using specialists vis-a-vis the primary care homes. And by emphasizing this comparability in some ways to the roles of those specialists in relation to the psychiatric kinds of specialists, it not only will help to improve and change how specialists are used, but also could redound back to making it clearer that psychiatrists and other psychiatric specialists can and should be used in this model in this way. So it has a kind of mutually beneficial effect to expand the emphasis and the applicability of this model.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you for that comment. This is Catherine again. And in fact, we are working right now on a second integration guide, which will be on integrating oral health into the primary care medical column. So that's an example of that. But as you said, there are many others.
Well, it's no coincidence that this McCall Institute's a major part of this, where David McCullough works and has long resisted having his own diabetes office, and was a peripatetic diabetologist working with primary care docs all across the group health system. I think it's a great model for a number. You can imagine dermatology, rheumatology, cardiology. And the same concept we talked about earlier, that this not only affords patients better integrated care, but it builds capacity in primary care.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guys hear me?
This is Anna, and I just want to emphasize, I think that's the major reason why it's so important that those specialists are used in new ways. And this would be, so this guide is focused on the safety net medical home. I think those principles are applicable because there are not enough psychiatrists in any, you know, population that we're trying to help serve to really meet the true needs, mental health needs of our population at large. So thinking of these creative ways, and I think that's true with other medical specialists as well. So I agree with that completely.
This is Ken Thompson. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi everybody. I have to apologize. I'm coming into this phone call a little bit late. I've actually been working as a psychiatrist in a HIV medical home and just today, so just finished up with patients. But I wanted to raise a question which I think is a bit of a monkey wrench if I'm understanding what's being said. I think of myself more as a specialist along the lines of an internist or a family practitioner or an OBGYN or a pediatrician, as opposed to being a dermatologist, cardiologist, neurologist, nephrologist, because I think that my role as a primary care psychiatrist is very different than a specialty, secondary specialty service. I'm actually working in primary care settings as a primary care provider in the context of a team. So I'm wondering how that fits. It seems to me we're picking a particular group of specialists to identify with rather than the primary care specialists. Am I being totally antithetical to what folks are describing?
This is Anna. I think that a lot of psychiatrists who end up working in primary care settings probably have a dual role. I think part of their time is spent working more like a traditional specialist, but they may also be playing a primary role in delivering services in primary care settings as well, which may be a little different than some other types of specialists. Although I think there are a lot of practices that actually have dermatologists come in for a day a week. So I guess maybe you're talking to a certain extent about the two different kinds of roles that psychiatrists can play as part of teams. At least that's one way that I think about it.
Right. I guess I would say I'm working now half-time in a primary care setting as part of a team of a behavioral health team that's part of the overall, whole person health team that we've assembled. And there's a real distinction between specialty psychiatric care that's done in secondary settings versus psychiatry and mental health care that's provided in a primary care setting.
Ken, this is Dr. Patron. It's Dr. Patron. Ken, you're raising a very good point. I found that my psychiatric colleagues around the country, as we've talked this over the years, have recognized that there's a huge educational role for being integrated. As a pediatrician, again, very interested in developmental and behavioral pediatrics, I want to work at the top of my license, as do all primary care providers out there. Nurse practitioners and physician's assistants as well. Having a primary care specialty on site, I love the way you say that, allows us to you to take a certain percentage of your time and educate us so that we work at the top of our license without going past it. So that really is one of the beauties of a medical home and an integrated medical home at that. So thanks for your comment.
This is Lauren Agratis from Family Voices, New Jersey. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, great. I just had a quick question on systemic issues, particularly with the managed care population. I was pleased to see that the pediatric population was included in the guide. Just wondering if you have any suggestions for what PCPs can do. Because what I'm seeing is early discharge from inpatient facilities resulting in ER visits and preventable rehospitalization, which is obviously not cost-effective.
This will be our last question. Go ahead.
This is Anna Ratcliffe. I would say I think there's a couple of things. I think one of the really nice things about this behavioral health guide being in the context of the larger suite of materials for the Safety Net Medical Home is that there are some really nice guidance provided around important care transitions, and one of those care transitions is out of the hospital. And we don't talk about that as much specifically within the integrated behavioral health guide, but I think there's a huge opportunity there to work if you have a in your community to work on those care transitions and utilize a behavioral health specialist to really catch those patients as they're coming out of the hospital more effectively and engage them so that you hopefully can get them the support they need to actually do well as they're coming out of the hospital. I think that's even more critical in our current climate because I think hospitalizations are much shorter. And so thinking about how we're going to do that reintegration into community support more effectively, especially if people may not yet have had time to set up more intensive services, often having that ability to work with those families, to be able to give them access more rapidly so that they're not waiting a month for their first appointment after an inpatient hospitalization, for example, is a huge benefit of having integrated behavioral health services as part of your suite of services that you do as a safety net medical home. I'm happy to have other people comment as well.
Catherine, do you have any final comments?
No, I thank everyone for participating today, for the good questions and thoughtful feedback. And again, we're eager to hear as you dig into these resources. So please feel free to send additional questions, additional thoughts. And just a reminder, all of the materials are in the public domain. They're on the website that Tara sent out earlier with the executive summary. So we encourage everyone to use them and share them at will.
This is Dr. George Patron. Thank you, Catherine and Anna, for joining us today and presenting this. Also, all the folks who have dialed in. Tara, can you remind us, will this discussion be, it has been recorded, will it be put on the PCPCC site for anyone who came in late or wanted to tell others to listen to it?
That is correct, George. Thank you. So if you're looking for the recording, I'll have it up by the end of the day. You can look under Stakeholder Centers, the Behavioral Health Group, and you'll see on the sidebar call recording. So thank you, everyone. We really appreciate you calling in and taking your time, and hope you have a lovely afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.